marvelous story. And so they wondered whether he was like that in, quote, real life. And so Max, his better half, is going to let us know whether it was true or not. Max wanted me to tell you. I asked her, what do you want me to say, Max, when I introduce you? I have no credentials. And I thought, living with a man who suffered like that, with his disease, must have given her a lot of credentials to go through her own suffering. She told me, would you believe this? You know, we heard the other day that he was, they've been married for 50 years when? December? Is that right? In December? They were, I think I've got this right, next door neighbors at the age of 4 years. Can you imagine that kind of a relationship for that long? I jokingly said to her, should have known better, but I guess not, you know. Anyhow, let's give Max a great hand because she is going to have a chance to tell her side of the story. Max, welcome.
Hi, my name is Max. I'm a happy member of Al-Anon. Paul always says I give the perverted version of his story, and I just like to remind all of you that I was the one that was sober. Anyway, it never would have occurred to me to go to Al-Anon because I didn't think our problem had anything to do with drinking. I thought Paul was crazy. So my solution was to try to find him a psychiatrist, and he wouldn't go, so I went. And I thought that if I went, I could maneuver him into going. Well, it didn't work, and I ended up going 3.5 years. I didn't learn anything about myself because I went to 4 different psychiatrists, and none of them talked. And I would go in and sit, and they wouldn't say anything, and I wouldn't say anything, and then I would think about all this money it was costing me, and somebody had to talk, so I talked. And I told them what my older daughter was doing and what Paul was doing, and each week I'd go back and give him a new story. The first one I went to, I didn't like him at all because everything I said, he laughed. And I didn't think the things I was telling him were very funny. And after he had me tested. I took the Minnesota multiphasic test, and I had the feeling that I was being tricked. Because it seemed to me that they ask a question, and then about 10 down, they would ask the same question, only worded a little differently. So I was very careful when I took that. And I also took the Rorschach test, and I had heard that that had something to do with sex, so I was particularly careful with that one. And I only saw animals. After we were on the program, I talked to some alcoholic woman, and she had done the same thing. Well, when he gave me the results, he told me I was very rigid and would never change. And I was horrified because I was the only one doing anything about this mess. And here was this professional saying, you might as well give up because nothing's going to change. Well, anyway, I think I had quit going to a psychiatrist maybe 3 or 4 months before we finally ended up on the program. But anyway, like I say, Paul would never go, and we had no communication. It seemed like if I were in the living room, he would be in the bedroom or vice versa. And one Sunday morning, I was showing Paul some rest spots on the floor of the family room, and all of a sudden, he was on the floor having a convulsion. Now, I'd never seen anybody have a convulsion before, so I was terrified, and I called the doctor in the next block. And he finally got there, and then Paul wakened, or whatever they do when they come out of a convulsion. And so Art decided that Paul should go in the hospital. And he called an ambulance, and I rode in the ambulance with Paul. And when we got there, he refused to stay overnight unless I stayed too. So I slept in the next bed. And in the morning, he felt fine and came home. While he was there, a neurologist saw him. And he wanted Paul to come into his office the following Wednesday and have some lab tests. So I had to drive him over there, and when we walked into his consultation room, Paul proceeded to tell him that the only problem was it was a marital problem. Now, I couldn't understand how I could cause him to have a convulsion, but if he said so, it had to be true. I believed everything he said. I thought he was crazy, but if he said something, you know, it was gospel truth. I've learned on Al-Anon that that ain't necessarily so. Anyway, he refused to have any of the tests, and we went back to living the way we had been. Another thing that I did is I went to priests, and I didn't go to the parish priest. I would go to somebody I didn't know. And I heard about this chaplain over at St. Joseph's Hospital in Orange, and I called and made an appointment with him, and he told me that in marriage counseling, he would talk to the wife alone, and then he would talk to the husband alone, and then he would talk to the two of us together. And I hadn't bothered to tell Paul where I was going, and I was gone for hours. And when I came home, he wanted to know where I'd been. So I told him, and I said, he wants to see you. And so he very reluctantly agreed he would go. And I got on the phone and made the appointment for the next day. And anyway, he went over, and he was gone a long time, too. And when he came home, he was furious. And I asked him if we were going to go see the priest together, and he said, no, I'm not going back. So I waited till the next day, and I called the priest, and I asked him what happened. And he said, your husband is the most stubborn man I've ever seen. And that was the whole explanation. We found out later that this priest was also an alcoholic, drinking at the time. So no wonder they didn't get along. I made a married couple's retreat, and I went alone. Nobody thought this was strange. My husband was a doctor, and he couldn't get away, but I really went to talk to the priest. And he came to the same conclusion that I did, that Paul needed psychiatric care, but I didn't know how to get him there. So anyway, after the first convulsion, I mean, things went back to the way they had been before. And then 14 months later, one Saturday night, I was watching television in the living room, and I heard this noise back in the bedroom. And I walked back, and there's Paul on the floor having a convulsion. So I sat down on the edge of the bed, and I watched him. And when he finished, I said, you've had a convulsion. You better go to bed. I was an old hand at this by this time. So the next day, I called the neurologist and told him. I used to call him for everything. Several of the doctors in our building approached me about Paul's changed personality, but I wouldn't say anything to them because I thought, if I told them how we were living, Paul would kill me. And anyway, this doctor, the neurologist, we didn't know him socially, so I would call him for everything that happened. And I don't know, he threw me off because he told me that Paul either had a brain tumor or early senility or something else, I don't remember. And then Paul told me he had a brain tumor, you know. And if he said it, it had to be true. So I was focused in on that. I knew he drank. You know, I drank with Paul for years, drink for drink. And as he often says, that he won by analogy. Anyway, when he had the second convulsion, when I called the neurologist the next morning, he suggested that Paul go back to the Mayo Clinic. And it took a month to get in. And during that month, Paul changed his mind a dozen times. And eventually, he did decide to go. And it was the middle of December. In fact, it was the day that Walt Disney died. I always remember that. And I don't know why we did this either, because we went back on Friday, and Paul wasn't going to start through the clinic until Monday. But anyway, that's the way we did it. And I made up my mind that I was going to get in and see the neurosurgeon and tell him about the pills that Paul was taking. Now, at that time, I really didn't know what pills would do to you, but there had been a young doctor in our town who died from an overdose, and everybody knew that he was on drugs, and I guess nobody knew what to do about it. And I used to think this is going to happen to Paul, but I didn't know what to do either. So I decided that when we went back there, I was going to see this neurosurgeon and tell him that Paul was taking pills at night. I assumed they were sleeping pills. So Paul started through the clinic on Monday, and it took me till Thursday to get up enough courage to go over and see this doctor. And I went over, and I remember it was a huge waiting room, and everybody in that room was a patient. And if you were a patient, you had a number. Well, I wasn't a patient. I didn't have a number. And I don't know what I told that gal, but she let me in. So I told the neurosurgeon, and when Paul went in the next day to get his lab results, they locked him up in the nut ward. And it was the day before Christmas, and I went over to see him, and he wanted out. And the only way he could get out was for me to agree to take responsibility for him. And I didn't know whether I should do this or not, but he told me that if I didn't agree, he would never speak to me again. So what could I do? I didn't know what a good opportunity that was. Anyway, he promised he wouldn't drink anymore and he wouldn't take any pills. And I don't remember what all he promised me, so I agreed. And we got on the plane the next day and had a big fight over whether or not he'd drink the free booze. I won. He didn't drink, but he wouldn't talk or eat either, all the way back to California. And when we got back, he got himself a bottle and drank it all. But then that was my fault, because if I hadn't argued with him, he wouldn't have done that, right? Anyway, the next morning I was up at 4 o'clock. I was frantic because I felt I had lost my last chance to get him medical help. And finally it was 9 o'clock and I could call this neurologist and tell him what happened. And he asked me whether I thought Paul would see a local psychiatrist. And I said, well, I don't know, because I had tried that once before during the drinking. The last one I went to, after I'd gone to him a while, he decided he wanted to see Paul. So he went in and he stayed about 5 minutes and said, I have nothing to say, and that was the end of that. And a funny thing happened after we were on the program 5-6 years. Paul was asked to be on a panel by Dr. Persh, who was in charge of the Navy program at that time. And it was in Long Beach. And it was a dinner meeting, and we just assumed it was something for the Navy, so I didn't go. And they talked to the Long Beach Medical Association. And Paul said he noticed that this one doctor was sitting in the front row nodding and smiling, and he thought, gee, this guy must really be interested in alcoholism. And afterwards, he came running up to Paul and said, remember me? And Paul looked at his badge and said, were you at the VA hospital? He said, no, I was one of your wife's psychiatrists. And that was the fellow that I had gotten Paul to go see. And he was delighted to see him and acted like he knew all along what the problem was. But I really don't think so, because we never talked about drinking. And after we got on the program, Paul sent letters and literature to all of my psychiatrists and told them that I was on Al-Anon, he was on AA, and if they wanted to talk to us, we'd be glad to talk to them. We never heard from any of them. Anyway, when this neurologist asked if we'd see a local psychiatrist, and I think, again, it was the next day, and we went over and talked to this psychiatrist in Santa Ana. And in my searching for a psychiatrist, I had tried to get in to see this fellow one time. I knew him only by reputation. He had a good reputation, but I didn't know that he treated alcoholics. And if I had known that, I wouldn't have even bothered. But I called the office, and I thought the only day I could go was a Wednesday. And the girl just said, we're not here on Wednesday, and hung up. And I never had the courage to call back. And I'm glad that that happened that way, because I think if I had been in there maneuvering and manipulating, it wouldn't have turned out the way it did. Anyway, we went over, and he talked to Paul for 45 minutes and talked to me for 10 minutes and locked him up in the local mat ward. And I knew he was in the right place. And I could go see him every day for an hour. And Paul spent his time locked up in the nut ward making lists of things for me to do to keep the world running while he was locked up in the nut ward. And you have to be pretty crazy to do that. But not nearly as crazy as me going over each day for my list like I did. And one day on the list was to go to the central office and pick up the big book. And I didn't know why he wanted the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the psychiatrist had somebody coming from AA and taking them to meetings. And I was just confused, because I had no idea why this was going on. And one Saturday night I went over to see Paul. And this fellow from AA came in, and Paul introduced us. And Frank said, we're going to an AA meeting. Would you like to go along? Now, I had heard of AA and I'd heard of Al-Anon. In fact, 10 years before we got to the program, I had sent back to New York for Al-Anon literature, Paul's patients. But I didn't read it. Why would I read that stuff? Anyway, so I didn't have anything else to do, so I said, okay. And we got in the car with this guy, and I thought he was a real kook. You know, he was telling us all kinds of personal things. And you don't talk to strangers like that. He was telling us about how he and his wife had broken up, and so he gave her guitar lessons for Christmas because he was trying to get back together with her. And then she ran off with a guitar teacher. And I thought, my God, what have we gotten into? Anyway, he took us to Laguna Beach, and it took about a half hour to get down there, and he talked all the way down. And Paul and I didn't say a word. And when we got down in the Canyon Club, we got together and decided we weren't going with him anymore. And I remember walking in there and being so afraid we were going to run into somebody we knew. And luckily we didn't for a year, and I'm grateful for that too, because I don't know whether we would have stayed, because our anonymity was very important. And when they had a visiting group come in, and when the meeting started, they turned out all the lights and just had candles, and then I could be comfortable. And I don't know, you know, there was a feeling in the room. I had no idea what to expect. And there was a feeling, I don't know how to describe that. And they laughed. And I hadn't laughed in a long time. And I really enjoyed the meeting, although I don't remember anything that was said. And I wanted to go back, but I don't think that I went to too many AA meetings when Paul was in the hospital. But then Frank had this Al-Anon gal call me. I think it was the next day. And I didn't like her at all. You know, she'd call me up a dozen times a day. I didn't have time to talk on the phone to strangers about Al-Anon, whatever that was. And besides, I worked. I didn't have time. You know, I was very busy. And I had a thing about wasting my time. And I didn't like women's clubs. And things were better. I knew where Paul was. He was locked up and safe. And I didn't have to worry about him. But anyway, I did agree that I would go to a meeting with her. And I went to 3 meetings with her. And she used to keep calling me up. And all the time she was telling me I shouldn't work for Paul. And, you know, finally I told her what she could do with Al-Anon. Because I realized now that that job working for Paul was my security. I didn't get paid, but it was a job. And so I quit Al-Anon. But I continued to go to AA with Paul. And he would go to 1 or 2 meetings a week, whether he needed them or not. And we'd always go to Laguna Beach because we couldn't figure out the schedule. And if the meeting started at 8:30, and if we got down there too early, we would go to Denny's and have a soda or something and get into the meeting at 29 minutes after 8, sit by the door, and on the way home we'd complain because nobody was friendly. Nobody talked to us. You know, they didn't even know we existed for the first year because I wasn't going to Al-Anon and Paul certainly wasn't talking to anybody in AA meetings. Anyway, 10 months later, they had a Southern California convention in Anaheim, and that's where we lived at the time. Incidentally, Paul's badge says Anaheim, and mine says Laguna Niguel. We're really not separated. We both live in Laguna Niguel. Anyway, we did live in Anaheim then, and on Saturday afternoon, they had an Al-Anon meeting, and Paul didn't go to the meeting, and that was different for me, too, because I usually didn't do things on my own. And I went to the Al-Anon meeting, and I went in and sat in the end, back of the room. And one of the gals who had driven in the car when I went to those 3 meetings came in and spoke to me. And she said, "Why don't you come and sit with us?" And I was very grateful to Martha because I certainly didn't feel a part of. And I went and sat with them, and I think for the first time heard something. We use the term release with love, which is detachment. It's the same thing. And that was the subject. And there were 4 women who talked. And I listened, and I decided that maybe Al-Anon did have something, and I would give it another try. But I thought Laguna is too far, and I would go to meetings closer to home. Well, I went to this one meeting for 6 weeks, and I didn't get anything out of it. All these people did was complain and talk about their alcoholic. And even as sick as I was, I realized that they were living in the problem rather than the answer, and I didn't think that would help me, so I decided to go back to Laguna. And I made a commitment that I would go on Monday, no matter what was going on in the office. And it was, like I say, a noon meeting. And I would go in, and they had tables set up, and I would try to figure out where I could sit that they wouldn't notice me. And it seemed like no matter where I sat, that's where they started. And I'm sitting there thinking, what am I going to say? It was like they were speaking a foreign language. I didn't know what they were talking about. And the same was true in AA. They would talk about 502s, which was a drunk driving charge. We didn't know what that was because Paul drank at home. And then they talk about being 86th. He was never 86th. I mean, I guess I could have 86th him, but I didn't know about that. And then I remember one alcoholic woman stood up there one time and she said she always wanted to be a hooker. And I turned to Paul and said, "What's a hooker?" I lived a very sheltered life. I've learned a whole new language here, I'll tell you. Anyway, I finally decided in Al-Anon that I would say, "My name is Maxine and I pass." And we do a lot of reading in the meeting I go to, and one of them is the 3 obstacles. And at that they say, you don't talk about religion and you don't gossip and there are no authorities, and that you do it in your own way in your own time. And this gave me permission to not talk. And then I could be comfortable. And I did that for a year. And I think those women in that meeting thought I was never going to talk, and I didn't plan on it either. And the only reason that I do this now is because we went to the International Convention in Miami in 1970, and Al-Anon put out a new book, and it was called The Best of the Forum. And for the alcoholics, the forum is like the grapevine, only it's for Al-Anons. And my first mistake was I bought that book. And in it, it said that it was your responsibility to share with others that others had shared with you. And then I got to feeling guilty because people had been asking me to talk, and I said, no, I don't talk. But anyway, after I read that, I thought, well, okay, the next time somebody asks me to talk, I'll talk. And if they don't like me, they don't need to ask me back. And they didn't for a long time. Anyway, then I could be comfortable, and I didn't have to worry because all I have is my story. I think they sent me this thing to send in my credentials. I don't have any credentials. Anyway, so then I got comfortable in that meeting, and I remember in the beginning I would sit there and think, what am I going to say? And I'd figure out what I could say. And then I'd open my mouth and something else would come out. I don't know why that happened. I gradually got comfortable in that meeting. And I remember the first time that I was able to release my older daughter, and I was so excited, and I went down there and I was going to tell them. Now I knew what they were talking about. That day they didn't call on me. Anyway, I was there for 12 years. And then we started to move. We lived in one house in Anaheim for 21 years. In fact, we had it built, and I thought we were going to stay there forever. Well, in 1979, we started to move, and we moved 5 times in 6 years. And I have turned over my will and my life to the care of God in everything except moving. And if my higher power wants to move, he's going to have to move by himself because I'm not moving anymore. That's a big job. I've learned an awful lot on Al-Anon, and I'm grateful because the meeting that I was taken to in Laguna was, there were at least a dozen women there who had been on Al-Anon a long time, and I learned a lot from them. When I think of all the things I have learned, I mean, I used to have to wait to see how Paul was going to act so I didn't know how to feel. And I did this for years. I've learned that I can be me. I don't have to be the person that Paul is telling me he wants me to be because I never did it right. Never did it right. And I'm a lot more comfortable, and I'm sure he is too. We were around a couple years before we were able to tell each other how we felt rather than what we thought. And that was a big breakthrough, too. It's not easy to do. But Paul could understand that maybe I could feel a certain way. And I could understand that he might feel a certain way, even though I didn't really understand. You know what I mean? And I was able to say, you know, I feel angry rather than you make me angry. And that's a touchy thing, too, because you have to tell your feelings without pointing the finger at the other person and saying it's their fault. And I've learned on Al-Anon, it really isn't what happens to me, it's my reaction to what happens. And I've used Al-Anon in things that have nothing to do with alcoholism. I've used it with my kids, and they've done things that I couldn't have handled if I hadn't had Al-Anon. And our older daughter left home when she was 18, and she was going to junior college. She had a little money, and she had a part-time job. Well, within 3 months, that was all gone, and the girl she was living with wanted to get her out. And so Paul and I and our other daughter had a little conference, and we decided we didn't want Ann at home either because she'd caused so much commotion. And so it was like, you know, somebody had been hitting me on the head with a hammer, and they suddenly stopped. And it felt good, and I didn't want to go through all that again. So I found a place for Ann to stay down in L.A., and we paid her room and board. So she went down there, and we didn't hear from her in months. I mean, she just didn't contact us at all. And so we went on vacation, and when we came back, Paul said, let's call Anne and see how she is. And we called down there, and the nun said, Anne moved out yesterday. And Paul said, do you think that we should try to contact her? And I said, no, I think she'll contact us. And I have to backtrack a little bit, too, because when I first started Al-Anon, everything I did, Paul would say, don't give me that Al-Anon crap. And so he decided to come to Al-Anon to see what was really going on and found out that we don't spend our time talking about the alcoholic. We have much more important things to do. And so he went with me. He loved it. And he went with me for a year and a half every week. And now he goes whenever he can. But anyway, like I say, we didn't know where Anne was. Well, she called, and she and her boyfriend came out on a Saturday, which was a couple days after we got back, and they were driving a rented car, and she had run up a $140 motel bill, and she wanted us to give her the money. And Paul told her he could only share his experience, strength, and hope with her, and he never had that experience, and so she'd have to figure it out for herself. So she left, and we didn't hear from her then until Monday when she called me at the office and she said, Daddy doesn't understand. She said, they're going to put me in jail. And I said, oh, okay, well, we'll see you around. And she said, what in the hell's going on here? Because always before when she'd do things like this, I was on the ceiling. And this was a new thing for her. And we didn't give her the money. And I think she had to sign a note and leave some of her clothes and leave some of her books. And I think she's a little bitter for a while because she wrote us a letter about all these great things she was going to do and that she wasn't going to be money-grubbing like some people she knew. And she's done a lot of crazy things. Her husband joined AA about 3 years ago, but Ann doesn't go to Al-Anon, even though I think she needs it. But I guess maybe when she hurts bad enough, she might do something. But they've done a lot of crazy things. I've never heard anybody talk about this. A short time after they were married, they and some of their friends decided that they did not like organized religion, and they were going to start their own church, and that she believed in baptism by immersion and wanted to know if they could use our pool for the baptism. And I said, ask your father. And he told them they could, and I don't know who got dunked because, you know, I didn't watch. But, you know, if I hadn't had Al-Anon, no way would that have happened. It's a freedom for me not to be involved in there are two adopted daughters, and I don't have to be involved in the things they're doing. I don't ask any questions. They tell me what they want, and I don't offer any advice. And like I say, I feel comfortable, and I'm sure they do too. And the other daughter, once I was able to release Anne, I thought, well, this is easy. But Paula was a whole new ball game. And she was going away to school. And she came home one time at Christmas. She'd been smoking marijuana and I don't know what else. But anyway, she was very hostile and belligerent. And she and Paula had some kind of a hassle in the morning. And she left. And then we didn't see her. And Paula was talking that night, so we went away. And when we came home, she still wasn't home. And the next morning I got up, and Paul had gone to the hospital. And I don't know how this started, because I had heard on Al-Anon, you share with your kids, you don't tell them. And I'd heard this over and over, but didn't seem to register. But anyway, I started to talk to Paula, and I told her how I felt about Paul, and how I felt about Anne, and how I felt about a lot of things. And I must have talked for an hour, and she didn't say anything. We heard later that she told this girlfriend that Mom and I had the nicest talk. Well, she didn't talk. I talked. And when Paul came home from the hospital, he called me in the bedroom and said, what happened? He said, there's a whole new atmosphere here. And I said, I don't know Paula any better, but she sure knows me better. And you know, we had a better relationship from that time on. It was just amazing. And another thing that happened with Paula, when we first started going to meetings, and we went to a lot of meetings, we'd always ask the girls to go along, and they wouldn't go. And then Paula told us later that the two of them would talk about how they were never going to get as involved as we were. And she said she watched us and watched us change, and she had a weight problem, and as a result went to OA. So a lot of the things that I've heard on the program, it's attraction, not promotion. A lot of things have come true. I feel that in Al-Anon, NAA, I'm sure, that it's not so much learning, it's unlearning. All the things that I thought were the right thing to do turned out not to be. Anyway, like I say, Paul and I had no communication, and during the drinking, I would think, we're never going to get anything settled unless we talk. So I would wait till about 11 o'clock at night, and that was my time to have the serious conversation. And it always ended up the same way. I'd cry and Paul'd be mad. And I'd wait a couple days and think, I didn't word that right. And I would try again. I would always do the same thing over and over and over. And by the time we got to the program, I really had given up talking to Paul. But I realize now, too, that what I thought communication was, I would talk until Paul agreed with me. That never happened, and I don't think it ever will, but today it's okay. Another thing, too, when I first started Al-Anon, I think the first words I heard was resentment, and I didn't have any of those, so I didn't have to worry about that. And also they read the do's and don'ts, and they say don't pour out liquor and don't hide liquor. Well, I didn't do that either until I'd been around a while, and then I remembered that during the drinking time, periodically Paul would get up in the morning and he'd say, I'm going to quit drinking and we're going to change all our friends, and I'd help him pour out the beer. And I just thought this was one of his kooky ideas. How could we change all our friends, you know? Anyway, throw all the beer out in the morning, and I thought that's a waste because I liked beer, and I'd think I'm not going to get as much the next time. So by that night, he would say to me, why don't you go to the store and get me 3 cans of beer? And we'd argue a little bit, and I'd always end up going and feel a little silly taking the 3 cans out of the 6-pack, but I'd do it. And on the way home, I'd think, well, when I get home, I'm going to have one. And when I got home, he didn't want me to have one. And I couldn't understand when I was good enough to go get it. I guess I could have bought 4. That never occurred to me. But knowing what I know now, if I had gotten 4, Paul would have wanted 4. Another thing we did is Paul treated a family, or a doctor's family, and every year Charlie would give Paul a case of scotch. And he'd drink a couple of bottles, and the rest I would hide. Now, I don't understand this, why I couldn't see that there was a problem. But I grew up in a family. My parents died when I was very young. My mother, I was 4 months old when my mother died and about 3 when my dad died, so I never really knew them. So I lived with my grandmother part-time and I lived with my one aunt part-time. And when I lived with my grandmother, I had 2 uncles that were alcoholics. I knew what their problem was. And when I lived with my aunt, her husband was. I had no problem with that, but Paul did not fit the picture of what I thought an alcoholic was. So, you know, I wasn't able to see it. And I just recently have come to the conclusion, too, that one of the reasons that I denied so much was I didn't know what to do about it. So I just didn't see it then. I mean, I didn't have the answer, so I didn't see it. It wasn't there. And anyway, so after I would hide this booze, I would put them up in my cupboards and in my dresser drawers and any place I had a place for them. And then periodically I'd go back and I'd count them. And then I couldn't remember how many I'd put there in the first place. And one time I had an extra gallon or a quart of scotch, and I had no place at home to put it. So I took it down to the office, and we had an L-shaped desk, and there was a cupboard under there that we never used. So I thought, that's a good place for that. And I pushed this quart of scotch in there, and it clinked up against another bottle. And I reached in and got an empty half pint of scotch. And I thought, those stupid cleaning people. It never occurred to me that Paul had put it there. But the dumbest part of all was I left my full quart. And after we came to the program, I went back and looked for all this booze, and it was all gone. He had found every bottle. Now, he must have thought he had a bonanza. He probably didn't know whether he is or I did. But anyway, I said earlier that we had moved a lot, and it was in 1979 that we started to move around and ended up finally in Redmond, Washington. And we only stayed up there a year. We decided to go back to California, which was about 4 years ago. And now I've gone back to the original Al-Anon meeting that I went to in the beginning. And that was interesting, too, because I have a hard time going to strange meetings. I feel the same way I did when I was new. I don't want to talk, and I just sort of want to melt into the wall. And that's what happened to me up in Washington. And I came back to that meeting, and we'd been gone out of Orange County for about 7 years. And I only knew maybe a half a dozen women, but I felt at home. That was my meeting. And to me, it has always been important. The people I met in the beginning have always been important to me. And so I'm grateful to be back at that meeting. And it's a big meeting because we have about 100 people there, and it's a discussion meeting. And it's amazing how many people that they can get to talk. And I've learned a lot from the newcomers, too. It's amazing to me these young gals come in and they learn so fast, a lot faster than I did. I used to say I was a slow learner, but now I like to say I was a fast forgetter. Anyway, in one of our moves, Paul told me that he had a bad back and he couldn't help me with the moving. So I was pushing all these big boxes around, and I noticed a film in front of my eye, and I thought, oh, well, it'll go away. Well, 6 weeks later, it was still there, and so I finally decided maybe I should have it checked. So I called a new doctor that I'd never been to before, and the girl wanted to know how long I'd had this, and I told her a month. And so she set my appointment up for another month, and I know what she was thinking. She probably thought, if you've had it that long, it couldn't be that important. But anyway, when Paul came home from the hospital that night, I asked him to check my eye with his ophthalmoscope. And he looked and he couldn't see anything. And I don't know why I did this, but I put my hand over my good eye and I could only see him from the eyebrows up. So when I told him that, he got on the phone and moved my appointment up to the next day. And I saw the doctor about 5:30 at night, and he told me that I had a detached retina. And since I didn't know when it happened, he told me that I would either lose the sight in that eye or else I would have double vision. And so by 9 o'clock that night, I was in the hospital in bed with my eyes bandaged. And I laid there and thought, you know, I could be mad at Paul because I had mentioned this I don't know how many times. And he didn't act like it was very important. But then, you know, doctors' families don't get very good medical care. Or I could be mad at myself because I had had problems with that eye before. And I should have done something about it. And I thought, you know, what good would that do? This is reality. This is the way it is, and I might as well accept it. And I've also learned on Al-Anon that acceptance is not approval. I don't have to approve of something to accept it. And so I was very comfortable, and I went to sleep. And the next morning I went down for surgery, and the assistant surgeon turned out to be a fellow doctor I knew who was on AA. And I went into that surgery, and it was no problem, and I had no problem at all. And I lost a little sight in that eye, but I never did have double vision. So I have to believe that when I'm willing to turn my will and my life over to the care of God and everything except moving, that it's going to turn out better than anything I thought of. And when I first came to the program, when I tried to work that step, I would try all my methods first. And when they didn't work, I'd think, I don't care what happens. And then something would happen that I hadn't even thought of. And so, you know, when I first came too, I used to hear these women say they were grateful and happy and comfortable members of Al-Anon. I wanted to vomit. I'll tell you, I couldn't imagine why anybody would be grateful that their husband was an alcoholic. But today I am grateful. And I'm grateful that Paul's an alcoholic, that we could find this way of life. Thank you.